NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. 12 Democratic presidential candidates took to the stage in Westerville, Ohio last night. And while the Democratic presidential debate began with questions about the impeachment inquiry, it turns out the center of gravity wasn't around former Vice President Joe Biden and his son. Instead, it was on the woman to his left.
Senator Warren is more focused on being punitive or pitting some part of the country against the other.
Your signature, Senator, is to have a plan for everything. Except this.
And I appreciate Elizabeth's work. But again, the difference between a plan and a pipe dream is something that you can actually get done.
Well, in presidential politics, the debate stage pylon usually only happens when you're the front runner. So what does that mean about last night's debate? And what does it tell us about what's happening on the campaign trail? This hour on Point, dissecting last night's Democratic presidential debate. And you can join us. Did you watch? What did you make of the fact that everyone was chasing after Elizabeth Warren? Did you hear strong responses from the Democratic moderates like Pete Buttigieg or Amy Klobuchar? Well, joining us today from Columbus, Ohio, is Sahil Kapoor. He is national political reporter for Bloomberg News. He was at last night's debate in Westerville, and we've got links to his coverage at onpointradio.org. Sahil, it's always great to have you.
Great to join you, Meghna.
Okay, so a couple of debates ago, when we did a similar show, I asked the panel then, like, was it a get Joe Biden night? Universally, the agreement then was yes. So what about last night? Was it get Elizabeth Warren night?
Without a doubt, it was get Elizabeth Warren night. And many of the Democratic candidates on stage were treating her like the front runner. She had not been the target of their attacks in prior debates. And all of a sudden, she's caught up to Joe Biden in the polls. She's even overtaken him narrowly in some. And many of these other candidates are now targeting her, taking aim at her. Interestingly, it was the candidates who are courting more moderate Democratic voters. Think Pete Buttigieg, Amy Klobuchar, Beto O'Rourke. Now, all of these candidates have some progressive, flair within them, but they are fundamentally courting the moderate side of the Democratic primary electorate. And they used last night to go after Warren, to draw those contrasts, to portray themselves as more pragmatic in the hope of keeping their candidacies alive, because most, if not all of them, are at risk of being kicked off the next debate stage.
Okay, well, there were many moments like this. So let's listen to a couple of them. I mean, right off the bat, after discussion about the impeachment inquiry was sort of ushered off stage, they dove into issues of health care and specifically whether Elizabeth Warren would say that middle class taxes might go up with a Medicare for all plan. So Mark Lacey of The New York Times asked Senator Warren this question. And here you'll hear her answer and then a response from South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg.
I have made clear what my principles are here, and that is costs will go up for the wealthy and for big corporations, and for hardworking middle-class families, costs will go down.
A yes or no question that didn't get a yes or no answer.
So there was a lot of back and forth on healthcare on exactly this point, and ultimately, Senator Bernie Sanders took a moment to clarify his proposed policy, even if Elizabeth Warren simply wouldn't talk directly about taxes.
Well, as somebody who wrote the damn bill, as I said, let's be clear. Under the Medicare for All bill that I wrote, premiums are gone. Copayments are gone. Deductibles are gone. All out-of-pocket expenses are gone. We're going to do better than the Canadians do, and that is what they have managed to do. At the end of the day, the overwhelming majority of people will save money on their health care bills. But I do think it is appropriate to acknowledge that taxes will go up.
Senator Bernie Sanders at last night's debate. So Sahil, what I heard in that long exchange between several of the candidates was one, yes, Pete Buttigieg trying to separate himself, saying he doesn't necessarily support a Medicare for all plan. He wants a public option. Bernie Sanders essentially having to explain the ins and outs of his bill. But most importantly, Elizabeth Warren, even though she might actually believe everything that Sanders is saying, she will not have the words about middle class taxes come out of her mouth and captured on film. I think that's what was going on. Is that politically savvy of her or just evasive?
I think your analysis of this is exactly right. Elizabeth Warren has been asked that question more than a dozen times, I've seen her get asked that question over and over and over again, and she will never allow those words to escape her lips. She will never say, yes, it raises middle-class taxes, because she is worried that that soundbite is going to be used against her in a general election without the full context of the proposal, which is that, as the clip you played from Bernie Sanders shows, the Medicare for All plan would eliminate premiums and deductibles and all out-of-pocket costs. And what Warren will do, and what she's done dozens of times, and what I think she will do no matter how many times she's asked this question, is to reframe the question, the matter, to overall healthcare costs. Mm-hmm. So if you're paying $2,000 less in out-of-pocket costs and premiums and deductibles, and your taxes go up by, say, $1,500, you will still come out ahead. And that's the point she's trying to drive home, that middle-class Americans will, in the aggregate, come out ahead because of the health and medical costs that they save.
Right. But did that work for her last night on the debate stage? Because I presume that most people haven't really dug into the various plans in detail, but they might have seen, this several-minute-long exchange last night. Was Warren effective in trying to dance around the taxes issue and focus on costs?
It's really an open question. I think Buttigieg might have landed some punches there when he called her evasive and said she was refusing to, answer that question. If there are Democratic voters who do worry about Medicare for All, who do worry about the cost, who do want more specifics in terms of how things will be funded and the precise impacts that'll have, sure, that could have an impact. But this is also an issue that has been talked about extensively at every debate. I don't think there's anyone paying attention who doesn't already know where Elizabeth Warren stands and how she's talked about this. So we'll see. I remain skeptical that going negative in general is going to be helpful to candidates in this primary, because as we've seen in prior debates, when everyone kind of went after Joe Biden, ganged up on him, most notably in the second debate, it backfired because Democratic voters are so desperate to defeat President Trump that anything perceived as going against that goal and potentially bloodying up their nominee ahead of the general election will be met with skepticism.
Interesting. Okay, so hold that thought, because I want to come back to this issue of electability also and how going negative might have an impact on that. But we've talked a little bit about Pete Buttigieg. We will come back to him because I think he had quite a strong performance last night. But I also want to just hear from you briefly, Sahil, about Amy Klobuchar, because I think we saw a different Senator Klobuchar on stage last night than we have in previous debates. I mean, for example, when there was discussion about Senator Warren's proposed wealth tax, during the debate last night, Senator Warren herself actually accused the other candidates on stage of trying to protect billionaires when they weren't all gung-ho for a wealth tax. And Senator Amy Klobuchar then said this in response.
I want to give a reality check here to Elizabeth, because no one on this stage wants to protect billionaires. Not even the billionaire wants to protect billionaires. We just have different approaches. Your idea is not the only idea.
Amy Klobuchar there mentioning or referencing Tom Steyer, who was also on the stage. So Sahil Kapoor, that line about your idea is not the only idea. How did Klobuchar do?
This was the most aggressive Amy Klobuchar I've seen. This is the first time I've seen her go after a rival in a pretty systematic fashion. And again, I think she's trying to convey that she can draw the contrast with the left wing of her party, and she is someone who can be seen as pragmatic, who can be seen as a doer, and who can be trusted to live in the here and now and get things done. That was the message she was trying to convey. And Amy Klobuchar is one of the people who is at risk of getting thrown off the next debate stage. She's averaging just a couple of percentage points in the polls. So she needed to do something dramatic to try to hold on to that support and to make the next debate stage when the qualifying thresholds rise. I think that's a lot of what was going on there.
Okay. I got a sense towards the end of the debate, Sahil, that even former Vice President Joe Biden was enjoying for once not having the target on his back, right? I mean, because you remember that there was that very testy exchange between Biden and Warren about the creation of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Of course, that was sort of the brainchild of Elizabeth Warren that was brought into being in the Obama administration. And last night, here's the exchange between Biden and Warren, which got a little feisty and then led to this.
I got votes for that bill. I convinced people to vote for it. So let's get those things straight, too.
Senator Warren, do you want to respond?
I am deeply grateful to President Obama, who fought so hard to make sure that agency was passed into law. And I am deeply grateful to every single person who fought for it and who helped pass it into law. But understand,
you did a hell of a job in your job.
Thank you.
Sahil, what did you think of that moment?
A little bit awkward. I mean, Warren did not say the words, but she was essentially trying to convey to Biden. Her message was, stop taking credit for something I did. Right? Biden said in the previous exchange that he helped get votes for the CFPB. And her response was, well, I'd like to thank President Obama for helping get that done. Her message was, this is something she did. And keep in mind, the reason this came up was that Joe Biden said just moments before that sound you played, or maybe seconds before that sound you played, that he's the only one on that stage who's gotten significant things done. That's a bold statement. And yes, Joe Biden absolutely skated last night in the debate. Nobody really laid a glove on him. He was not the target. He has been the target in previous debates because he was the clear frontrunner going into previous debates. He was not the clear frontrunner going into this debate. I would say he and Warren were tied as frontrunners, and everyone thought they would take swings at Warren instead.
Yeah. And, you know, for those people who've been following both Biden and Warren's career for a while, there was a lot of backstory about how they've butted heads before on major pieces of legislation like bankruptcy protection. There's all that kind of lurking in the background there. But we have a lot more to dig into about what last night's Democratic presidential debate reveals about what may be happening on the campaign trail right now. So Sahil Kapoor, stand by for just a moment. We want to hear from you. Folks out there, did you watch the debate last night? What did you think of the pylon on Elizabeth Warren? Or did you see some strong performances from other candidates? And what does it make you think about the Democratic field as we inch ever closer to the first set of primaries and caucuses in the beginning of 2020? We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/OnPoint. That's Indeed.com/OnPoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about last night's Democratic presidential debate, really dissecting what happened in that debate and asking what it tells us about what might be developing on the campaign trail right now. I'm joined today by Sahil Kapoor. He's with us from Columbus, Ohio. He's national political reporter for Bloomberg News and was at last night's debate in Westerville, Ohio. And joining us now from New York is Aisha Moody Mills. She's a CNN political commentator and Democratic political strategist. She's former president of and CEO of the LGBTQ Victory Fund and Institute and former executive director of the Congressional Black Caucus PAC. Aisha Moody Mills, welcome to you.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
It's great to have you. So, you know, you heard us talking with Sahil about, you know, whether or not last night was Get Elizabeth Warren night. He seems to say yes. I just wanted to check quickly with you. Was Elizabeth Warren really kind of the center of last night, or one of the centers of last night's debate?
Yeah, and you have to imagine that her campaign is very proud of that. Very much so. The candidates saw her as the big fish to go after and try to take down. And that means that it's because she's the greatest threat. She's the one who's rising. If you look at the trend so far across this political cycle, Elizabeth Warren is the only candidate who has consistently gone up in the polls, gone up in her fundraising. She is on an upward trajectory. Everyone else is either declining or standing still.
So they
came for her.
So I guess the question is, how did she weather it, right? Because it's very much a double-edged sword to be you get a lot of face time and talk time in the debates when you're the one everyone's chasing after, but there's a lot of risk for misstep as well. So how'd she do?
You know, I have not experienced Elizabeth Warren to misstep much. One thing about her and why her campaign is doing so well is that she's extremely disciplined. She was very prepared. They knew that they were going to be attacked, and they knew exactly what they were going to be attacked on. And what she's very good at is standing her ground. And so I think that she weathered it very well. If you think about the debates, though, Elizabeth Warren is not winning, if you will, this primary at this moment in the polls because of the debates. Her debate performances are always steady. Sometimes she may have a little sarcasm. She's able to throw a little jab without really offending. But for the most part, it's pretty rock steady. She's not kind of peaking. She's not doing anything that's really exaggerated. And I think we saw that last night as well. Super consistent, very relatively calm in terms of taking the attacks. And I found there's one thing I wanted to share that I thought was brilliant. Maybe I'm the only one who noticed it. She did get a deep dig in but did it in a way that there was a smile. She didn't name names, but we all knew what she meant. When Kamala Harris was trying to attack her over Twitter continuing to have Trump's account up and trying to force her to come at Twitter and say, hey, you should get rid of this account, what she did is flip that whole conversation into essentially an attack on the hypocrites on that stage who all take money from big corporations and these big CEOs and then have the audacity to think that they're going to hold them accountable. And she pretty much was looking at Kamala and saying, hey, you're one of the people I'm talking about. But she was able to flip that and do that without being nasty. And I think that's how she performs generally. She's solid. She doesn't have to be nasty. She can take the hits and keep it moving. And it doesn't really – it just really bounces off of her.
Yeah. So, you know, I take your point about her recent rise in the polls isn't directly correlated to her debate performances. But I wonder if, you know, for folks who haven't been paying attention, you know, who don't live in Iowa or New Hampshire or South Carolina, could last night, if they did tune in last night, could last night's debate have opened their eyes to the possibility that Elizabeth Warren is the front runner?
Yeah, I think anytime you have a national stage, it matters. Her town halls, her forums that she does, they all matter. It gives her a soundbite to be able to tweet out, etc. So sure, the goal is to have more people paying attention to what she's doing. But here's what I think is most interesting. Warren has a massive campaign infrastructure on the ground talking to regular voters. And that's where we see a real uptick in people understanding who she is, what she stands for, and feeling connected to her. She announced the fact that she's taken like 70,000 selfies with people. That's 70,000 people plus their networks times six that all now feel some personal connection to Elizabeth Warren because she's in a photo with someone that they know or they're associated with. Her Iowa infrastructure is deep. She is on the ground talking to voters all day, every day. And so, you know, we like to pretend that these things are one and done in the media. Mm. But the truth is that they're actually one and done on the ground. Barack Obama proved that in Iowa when he was way behind in the polls and all the glitz and glam and the debates looked like Hillary Clinton was going to do it. But the truth is that we had to get out there and talk to real people. And that's, I believe, why we're seeing the Elizabeth Warren surge and why we're seeing everyone else either stand still or have a pop-off moment like when Kamala did when she attacked Biden in that first debate. But that fizzles and burns, right? Because you're not maintaining those conversations with voters.
Okay, so the ground game being everything in primary season. Sahil Kapoor, let me turn back to you. I mean, a lot of the conversation for several months now, though, about the Democratic field writ large is electability, electability, electability. Has that focus shifted at all? Has Elizabeth Warren, through her campaigning in key states or on the debate stage, has she answered that question of electability?
I don't think the focus has shifted among Democratic voters in the sense that they are very, very eager to pick a candidate they believe can beat President Trump, even if it's not the candidate they agree with on most issues. But the dynamics within the primary on this issue of electability have really changed. When Joe Biden entered the race in, I believe it was around April, he was far and away seen as the most electable candidate. And now that gap has narrowed. His advantage has narrowed. The polls have changed to the point where he's not the one who is clearly beating President Trump in one-on-one contests in national surveys. A recent poll showed him leading Trump by 10 points and Elizabeth Warren also leading Trump by 10 points. So Warren has made serious gains on this electability question. And she still trails Biden. But the way her campaign sees it, is that they don't have to necessarily win the electability argument. They don't have to convince Democratic voters that she's more likely than Biden to defeat President Trump. They just have to neutralize his advantage on this because they believe they have other advantages on message, on policy issues, on activating progressive voters and enthusiasm that can carry her to victory, as long as she's not seen as someone who's doomed in a general election.
Well, let's listen to a moment where one of the candidates directly focused on the opponent that the eventual Democratic nominee will face in the general election, of course, that being President Donald Trump, presuming that the Republican primaries go as one might expect. But here's what New Jersey Senator Cory Booker said.
We've got one shot to make Donald Trump a one-term president. Mm-hmm. And how we talk about each other in this debate actually really matters. I've had the privilege of working with or being friends with everybody on this stage, and tearing each other down because we have a different plan to me is unacceptable. I have seen this script before. It didn't work in 2016, and it will be disaster for us in 2020.
Senator Cory Booker last night in the Democratic presidential debate. Let's go to Claire, who's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Claire, you're on the air.
Hi, Magna. Thank you. Cory Booker just nailed it. I would beg the pundits, please stop talking about electability. It's a catchphrase. It's a red herring. Anybody on that stage, in my opinion, is electable. Let the voters decide. Did anybody think Donald Trump, for example, was electable in 2015?
Claire, thank you for your call. Aisha, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, thank you so much, Claire, for that. I really appreciate those sentiments. I agree. We've got to stop talking about electability, particularly because it is racist and it's sexist. When someone says, oh, is that person electable? They're generally suggesting that only a middle-of-the-road white man would be electable because somehow that represents the mainstream of America. But the truth is that there's a rising new American majority of progressive and liberal white folks, as well as coupled with people of color who are ultimately going to be the majority in this country demographically, that actually make up the majority in this country. And so if we're thinking about electability, we've got to get outside of these stereotypes of how that term is used. And I find it to be quite condescending, particularly because it's exclusionary. But at the end of the day, Claire's also right. Like, look, Donald Trump was a joke, and now he's sitting in the White House. People didn't think Barack Obama was electable, and Barack Obama served two terms. And so when we start off, and Elizabeth Warren says this a lot on the stage, when we start off limiting ourselves to these preconceived notions about what should or shouldn't be, what we do is we box ourselves into a trap of yesteryear that, frankly, is not progressive, forward-looking. It doesn't take us anywhere aspirational. And I think that that's problematic. I believe that voters, you know, are a little frustrated with that as well.
Well, Aisha, your point is well taken. But when people talk about electability, really, aren't they saying basically they're saying without saying that in the general election, you can't just, you know, win just based on Democratic votes, that you got to capture a pretty, you know, a significant portion of the middle of independents, for example. Maybe even some Republicans, if a Democratic candidate's going to win the White House. And what they're saying without saying is that they don't feel that America in 2019, 2020 is at a place where someone who's not a white, male, moderate Democrat can do that.
Yeah, and I resist that. I push back against that. I do not believe, and the data does not bear this out to be true, that Democrats will win by trying to pander to Republican lights. That's not where we are anymore. That's not how the country is divided up. The truth is that the way that Democrats win is by maximizing progressive white people, who we like to call the white woke, the woke white vote, and also people of color where it matters, and maximizing that turnout. It is a bit of a fool's errand, and Joe Biden, this is his strategy, to just say, I'm going to go get all those Republican, you know, working white guys and make them vote for me again, like back in, you know, Scranton, Pennsylvania, the day of my daddy. That's not how this is laid out anymore, and it's not the way that our maps are drawn out. So suburban white women who always become this beacon of the middle that we talk about, and I guess we can call them independent, sure, tend to be relatively liberal on social issues, things that and when you talk about children and education, et cetera, and those kitchen table issues. They may have voted Republican for, you know, people who were more moderate, but when it gets a little extreme, as we saw in 2018, they're going to come back to more liberal ideology. So I don't think that the play here is to say we're not going to stand for anything because we're trying to bring back some people who are gone. I do believe that the play is to stand for what we stand for as Democrats and maximize the people who believe in what we believe in.
Sahil, I'm going to come back to you in just a second, but there's one more question about this issue that I want to ask Aisha. I mean, Aisha, then do you think that candidates like Senator Amy Klobuchar are wrong? I mean, she talked multiple times yesterday or last night about the kinds of voters that she can reach.
Yeah, the thing is that I'm sitting here in New York City, right? I think about Philadelphia. I wonder, I think about Detroit. I wonder how Amy Klobuchar is going to do, even in the Midwest that she talks about, which is she plays the role of the Heartland homegirl so well. But is she pulling the urban areas in the Heartland? Because that's where the Democratic vote is ultimately also going to come from. So if she's not able to maximize turnout in Detroit, but she gets some people in Indiana, that doesn't get her the nomination. And so I want to be very realistic. I think that she's right in so much of what she has to say, and I think that she's a great bridge builder. And in Minnesota, and she talked about winning Michelle Bachmann's district, which is, you know, Michelle Bachmann's complete polar opposite than her. At the same time, though, we're talking about a national election, and I just don't know that she grips the hearts and minds and resonates with others in the Democratic base that really matter. So she's talking about the fact that she can pull one small group, but I don't know that that's mass appeal.
Sahil, do you want to chime in here? What do you think?
There's so much to unpack with this electability conversation, but I will say what Aisha is describing is the Elizabeth Warren strategy, which is to mobilize voters, to win by mobilizing. And the Joe Biden strategy, by contrast, is to win by capturing the center. He believes that Democrats can run kind of a similar playbook as they did in the 2018 election when they did win through the center in the 2020 election. And there was no autopsy after the 2016 election by Democrats. No official document or investigation by the party as to what went wrong and how they win, which is why this continues to be a very, very divisive debate going forward. And look, it is absolutely true that the conventional wisdom around electability has been not only wrong, but comically wrong for a while. Nobody doubted that Hillary Clinton and John Kerry and Al Gore were electable. Those conversations never came up and they all lost. Nobody talked about Donald Trump and Barack Obama being electable candidates in their primaries. And they both won. So there is the country is changing in that sense. It's not there's not one clear formula as to how to win. And Warren is pitching herself as a different kind of candidate who can succeed with this mobilization strategy because it is riskier. Last point I'll make on this. The cities that Aisha was talking about, Philadelphia, Milwaukee and Detroit, if Democratic turnout in 2016 in those cities was the same as it was in 2012, then Donald Trump would not be in the White House. So there is a theory as to how Donald Trump how Democrats can win by mobilizing their base without necessarily appealing to voters who, you know, supported Trump in 2016 and may not flip back.
Let's go to a quick call here again. Let's go to Sarah, who's calling from Kelowna, Iowa. Sarah, you're on the air.
Hello. I would like the moderators of the debates to talk to the other candidates, because all we ever hear is Bernie, Joe, and Elizabeth. How can we know if anybody else is electable if the moderators don't ask them questions?
Yeah. Sarah,
thank you.
That's
my comment.
Thank you for your call and your comment. Aisha, what do you think about that? I mean, there were 12 people on the stage, but the overwhelming amount of time did go to those, you know, top three or four in the middle here. And for voters like Sarah, who in order to make an informed decision, they want to hear from all the candidates. It's just not I mean, how can we make that possible in these debates?
I think the whole debate situation is a zoo. There were way too many people on that stage. And I say this because my wonderful colleagues at CNN have moderated several of these debates now. And it's a tough it's a tough challenge trying to get to everybody and allow them all to get words in, especially when the way the rules are set up is that they allow someone who is being named in an attack, if you will, in the debate to then respond. So since everyone was attacking Elizabeth Warren, it's not surprising that Elizabeth Warren also had the most number of minutes of anybody speaking, right? She had the most speaking time. I would love to see, in my opinion, I would love to see these play out in a way where they were even smaller. And I know we don't need like 5 days a week of debates, but to have 12 people on a stage just seemed unreasonable to me. I also would like to see more audience engagement. I think that would be really fun to get questions from folks who are in the audience who want to talk. So there are ways that I think we can change this up.
Well, Aisha Moody Mills and Sahil Kapoor, stand by for just a moment. We've got to take a quick break here. We're dissecting last night's Democratic presidential debate and what it might tell us about the shape of the race right now. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are dissecting last night's Democratic presidential debate and trying to understand what it might tell us about what's happening on the campaign trail right now. I'm joined today by Sahil Kapoor. He's national political reporter for Bloomberg News. He was at last night's debate in Westerville, Ohio, and he's with us today from Columbus, Ohio. Aisha Moody Mills is also with us today from New York. She's a CNN political commentator and Democratic political strategist, former president and CEO of the LGBTQ Victory Fund and Institute, and former executive director of the Congressional Black Caucus PAC. And I want to just take a moment to listen to a moment from the debate where they talked about foreign policy, because it was a particular exchange between the two veterans, the two military veterans on stage, South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg and Representative Tulsi Gabbard. They went back and forth quite a bit on the issue of U.S. involvement in Syria. And here's a little bit, a condensed version of some of their exchange.
So really what you're saying, Mayor Pete, is that you would continue to support having U.S. troops in Syria for an indefinite period of time to continue this regime change war that has caused so many refugees to flee Syria, that you would continue to have our country involved in a war that has undermined our national security.
No, you can embrace, or you can put an end to endless war without embracing Donald
Will
Trump's policy.
Will you end the regime change
doing.
War is the question.
What we are doing.
What is an endless war if it's not yet another regime change
Please.
War?
What we are doing, or what we were doing in Syria, was keeping our word. Part of what makes it possible for the United States to get people to put their lives on the line to back us up is the idea that we will back them up, too.
South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg and Representative Tulsi Gabbard in last night's presidential debate. Sahil Kapoor, what did you make of this moment? Because foreign policy and this moment right now, literally at this time, is a place where I believe that, you know, the current sitting president in the White House is quite weak. How do you think the Democrats engaged with it?
It was an interesting divide within the Democratic Party between figures like Joe Biden and Pete Buttigieg, who are internationalists, who are interventionists to varying degrees, and people on the other side of that spectrum, not just Tulsi Gabbard, but also Elizabeth Warren, who said something along the lines of, I would like to get out of the Middle East, or you know, that she prefers to end U.S. involvement in the Middle East. But on the other hand, those people are also conflicted in the sense that nobody really approves of the way President Trump has handled the situation.
Right.
In
Warren
Syria.
Warren said she'd want to get out, but in the right way.
In the right way, exactly. So there is this sentiment not only among the not only within the Democratic Party, but among Americans overall, that the U.S. is spending too much time and resources and too much money in the Middle East for very little return. So I think what Democrats are grappling with is, number one, the immediate reaction to what President Trump is doing and the way he's handling it, and the bigger picture of what kind of a vision they should have in terms of U.S. involvement in the Middle East, because it's an extremely complex set of questions with no easy answer. Mm.
Well, Aisha, I wonder what you think particularly of Pete Buttigieg, because you heard in that moment and in a couple of other times during the debate last night, he spoke with clarity, with authority. He was definitely fearless about going after Elizabeth Warren and some of the other candidates. Sahil earlier in the show was talking about how that Buttigieg, has an opportunity here to try to peel off some votes, say, from Joe Biden. Was he effective?
Yeah, the number one thing that he was passionate, which we hadn't seen much from him before. I believe that he had the best night. So when I go through like who my winners are, it was Mayor Pete for sure. And it's exactly because of all those things that you said. For the first time, he was willing to take folks on. The truth is that the guy has a short record. He was mayor of a tiny city. He's got race relations issues. He doesn't have much experience doing a whole lot domestically. But with the conversation around Syria, like, he has a lot to say about the time that he served in the military. And I would like to hear a little bit more of that from him. I think he also is feeling really empowered by his fundraising numbers. Mm. I mean, let's be real. Mm. He may not be doing well in the polls, but he is raising a ton of money. He's in the top three this quarter, right behind Bernie and Warren. So he's feeling really emboldened, and he's definitely going to come out jabbing people. The other thing he's doing that's interesting is he's been trying to play throughout this campaign, he's been trying to play this generational divide. And he comes back all the time to saying, look, we've been doing this my entire lifetime, and it clearly didn't work. My entire life I've seen A, B, and C, and you guys were the ones who were elected doing this when I was a little boy, and it didn't work. I think he's playing that generational divide really well. And he's also, to me, definitely trying to hold on to his own millennial progressive bona fides, mm-hmm. just millennial values, but still attacking the far left, right? Coming to Elizabeth Warren and saying, this isn't reasonable. Like, we can't just be so ambitious that we do nothing in between getting to where you're trying to go. So I'm suggesting that we do all these different things that would at least move the ball forward. Right. So he's playing a really, really, really smart game. The truth is that I, like I said about Warren, I just don't know that the debate stage is where he ultimately can win. The debate stage is where he's raising money.
Interesting. Okay, so Sahil, on that point, if Buttigieg is doing well in fundraising, and also his burn rate is pretty high through that money, but he, as Aisha said, he's not necessarily advancing in the polls. What is missing for him on the campaign trail? Because, I mean, on paper, he makes for a pretty good candidate.
Yeah, Pete Buttigieg has a message that sounds like Elizabeth Warren and a policy agenda that looks like Joe Biden's. So he's playing this, he's offering a little bit for everyone. And he is raising an enormous amount of money, which means that he will have the resources to stay in the race for pretty much as long as he wants. But it's true that he's stagnated in national polls. He's at about 5%, hasn't shown much growth over the summer. He had an extraordinary surge of attention early on. You know, this little-known, unknown mayor from a mid-sized city, South Bend, Indiana. Nobody really heard of him. And he was one of the few people in this massive field who broke out. Now, I spent some time with Pete Buttigieg in Iowa on his bus tour. And that is a state where he's going all in. He has to do very well in Iowa. I pressed him to say, do you have to win? Do you have to do top three? And he wouldn't quite go there. But think about the map for him. after Iowa is New Hampshire. That's the backyard of two formidable rivals in Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. Nevada comes next. Large share of non-white voters, Hispanic voters who Buttigieg barely registers with.
And then South Carolina.
Black voters, majority of the electorate. He's getting somewhere around 0 to 1% among black voters. So he has to do very well in Iowa. It's a Midwestern state, not far from where he, you know, not far from where he grew up and where he lives. And it's an overwhelmingly white state with the kinds of voters that if he's going to make a mark, he has to do it there.
Aisha, in 2019, 2020, is registering between 0 and 1% with black voters in key states like South Carolina a recipe for any kind of political viability?
Nope, not at all. And he knows this, and that's why his plans, I mean, he's got this Douglas plan for African Americans. He has tried to bring some good people onto his campaign that have connections with the black community. He is a good listener. The one thing I really respect about him, and I like Mayor Pete a lot, even though we're talking about his deficits, is that he's a listener and he knows when he doesn't know. But the truth is that he doesn't know any black people. He doesn't have any personal relationships. He doesn't go to a black church. He doesn't, you know, there's just so many things that he's not going to be able to overcome in this primary to really reach the base of the Democratic Party and show that he is reflective of and can be representative of the beautiful umbrella of the rainbow. And I don't know how he overcomes that. I don't think that he overcomes it. In fact, as we go into Super Tuesday, you're still talking about a big chunk of those states being southern states like Virginia that have large African-American populations that are a significant part of that primary vote. So he doesn't get through Super Tuesday either. Now, the thing that he's going to do, though, is he's got a lot of money. So he's got enough money to drag this thing out to convention is what I'm expecting. I'm expecting that the people with the money will just keep on playing, even though those delegate counts don't quite come into fruition.
Wow.
Okay. And this is the short answer to your question, Meghna. What he's missing is non-white voters.
Right. Well, let's go to Fran, who's calling from Council Bluffs, Iowa. Fran, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I actually have a unique perspective on this. Back in March, I called into this show immediately after we had some pretty catastrophic flooding out in Pacific Junction, Iowa. That's where our home is. And since that time, we've had no less than seven of the candidates actually on our property coming to evaluate the situation, see what was going on there. And through that, and this happened basically throughout the summer, one candidate did kind of resonate with us, and that was Senator Klobuchar. And yesterday's performance, I was pleased to see people poke and basically point out the differences in their plans and ask for things from other candidates. Well, where do you really stand on this health care? How are you going to pay for it? Stuff like that matters. Mm-hmm. So it was interesting to see that. It's been interesting to see this evolve. I like Senator Klobuchar because I think she has an electability factor. I heard the discussions on that, and there's a lot of merit around that. But I also think she has the ability to work across the aisle and help unite us. Right. And I think that's where our country really needs right now. We got to think about how we're going to pull everybody together again to pull in the same direction.
Well, Fran, thank you so much for your call and for calling the show again after you were on several months ago. And thank you for that insight. Let's go to Stephen, who's calling from Powder Springs, Tennessee. Stephen, you're on the air.
Okay, thank you a lot. I appreciate the point. I'm a fan of the show, but I am thoroughly fed up with the DNC's race to the right. If Joe Biden or Amy Klobuchar or some of those that's heading to the right is nominated this fall or next fall, I will not be voting in the Democratic presidential race. I'll be staying home.
Really? Okay. Stephen, thank you so much for your call. Aisha Moody Mills, an interesting back-to-back there. I didn't actually expect it. Fran there saying she's looking for someone to cross the aisle. And Stephen there saying that he won't even show up to vote if he thinks that the Democratic nominee moves too far to the right. How do you square those two?
Well, first I would say to Stephen, sir, I would implore you to consider that the act of defiance of not participating is siding with the enemy. And so we don't win or move ourselves anywhere when we just choose to opt out, because we give power to the people that we actually don't want to have the power. But what Stephen is saying is really just so profound, that I hear this often among younger people of color, particularly young Black folks, is that the Democratic nominee has got to be first and foremost invigorating, inspiring, ambitious, and someone who can rally us beyond, you know, this idea that we just need to dump Trump, or beyond our fears. We actually need someone who's going to excite and animate us if we're going to maximize turnout. And to hear him say, like, look, Joe Biden, that we're doing this race to the right, like, this is not why I'm a Democrat. I'm not trying to be middle of the road. And if you guys want to be Donald Trump light, then you're not connecting with me, right? So I don't really feel like I should participate. That's real. And I believe the Democrats need to deeply listen to that. And here's the truth about, you know, this idea of electability and who can work across the aisle. I have not spoken to any voter who says that the reason why I voted for this person is because I think they're going to work across the aisle at the end of the day. It's not entirely up to the White House whether or not they get the opposite party to do what they want them to do. It's up to the president to be able to lead us on a global stage and to be able to drive ambitious ideas forward. If you look at Barack Obama's entire tenure, it's a miracle that Obamacare got done, because Mitch McConnell and the rest of the Republicans said on day one that their only task was to make sure that he was a one-term president. And then they couldn't do that. And so then they saw it to be their other task to block and tackle against anything he tried to do. And so it didn't matter if Barack Obama was the guy that could reach across the aisle and he was from the Midwest, because the other party wasn't going to play with him anyway. Mm. And I think it's foolish to suggest that, like, you know, that should be our metric, because it's not just up to that person. You know, it's up to the right. whole of all of the elected officials.
Ayesha, you're saying a lot of provocative things here. And Sahil, I have not forgotten about you, but Ayesha, I do just want to press you on something. I mean, your points are all well taken, but after, you know, year upon year upon year of political partisanship and divisiveness, and yes, the extreme rhetoric that President Trump himself used during his campaign and continues to do so. I mean, I'm thinking about caller Fran, who said, you know, there's a critical mass of Americans out there in the Democratic Party who want a sense of, like, someone who will unify the country. You can't just brush that off, can you?
Every single Democrat that is currently running for president is someone who has enough compassion, dignity, dexterity in the way that they engage with people that they disagree with, and humility, that they will all be better than what we currently have. So it's not a false dichotomy that either you are Republican light or you're like a progressive that's just rabid and out of touch. Like, no, anybody is going to have more sensibility than this current crazy guy that we got in the White House.
Sahil Kapoor, we've got about a minute left here. Sort of getting back to the day-to-day on the campaign trail. We've got Iowa and New Hampshire coming up in February, so a couple of months away yet. But is the window closing on the Amy Klobuchars, the Pete Buttigieg's, the other, you know, many of the other candidates we didn't even name check here yet, you know, Julian Castro, for example, in terms of trying to make inroads before we're right in the middle of people casting their votes?
The window is absolutely closing for about half of that debate stage, which is polling under the threshold that they need to qualify for the November debate. And if they're not on that stage, if they're not in sight of voters, they are out of mind. So it's critical for them. And I think this is why we saw a lot of the aggression from a number of these candidates that we saw last night. They want to stay relevant. Can I just say one point to earlier, you know, what the caller said earlier? There are 100 million eligible voters who stayed out and did not vote in the 2016 election. This is not a fixed electorate. And the big question Democrats have to ask themselves now is, do they try to win back those Obama to Trump crossover voters, get them to flip back to the Democrats, or do they try to inspire and mobilize some of these disaffected voters who think politicians are all the same and nothing is really going to change if they show up?
Well, Sahil Kapoor, national political reporter for Bloomberg News, with us from Columbus, Ohio today. Sahil, always great to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And Aisha Moody Mills, CNN political commentator, Democratic political strategist, former president and CEO of the LGBTQ Victory Fund and Institute, and former executive director of the Congressional Black Caucus PAC. Aisha Moody Mills, it was an absolute pleasure to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.